Welcome to this fourth lecture in the Darwin College lecture series on the subject of life. The subject is life in the ancient world, and we're concerned with human life in a society very remote from our own, not only in terms of time, over 2,000 years, but also very remote in terms of the meanings that life had for the people. And yet, of course, it was a society for which we have an extraordinarily rich literary and artistic legacy. Our speaker is Michael Scott, who teaches and researches here in Cambridge, where he received his training. And in a very short time, he's built up a very impressive academic record. He's written about the politics of Delphi and Olympia, and he's got another book coming out also to be published by CUP shortly on the use of space in Greece and Rome. But Dr. Scott also has an impressive record as a communicator of his enthusiasm through many media and to many very different audiences. I found wonderfully readable his book From Democrats to Kings about 4th century Greece, where he shows how a society can move dramatically backwards. And he's also the writer and presenter of a growing number of quite entrancing television documentaries on the classical world. It's a great delight to introduce Michael Scott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to begin with a thank you. Thank you to you all, of course, for coming on this cold and snowy night, but much more particularly, a thank you to Willie Brown, the master, and not just for taking a risk tonight in asking me to speak, but more generally for his time and work as master of Darwin College. Many of you will know that this is his final year, and while there will be many more people, far more important and eloquent than I, that will sing his praises over the course of that year, I wanted to just take a moment to say something as someone whose first academic job was at Darwin under his mastership. And I wanted to pay tribute to his ceaseless enthusiasm, his unending encouragement for the research fellows at Darwin, and for providing an example of the kind of academic that many of us would like to be. Willie, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. The last time I was up on the stage was in 2010 when Professor Mary Beard was talking about risk in the ancient world, and I was brought up as an unsuspecting participant in a live consultation of the oracles of Astrampsicus. Now, the oracle very kindly told me then that I would not be caught committing adultery, which, while useful, was not as useful as it would have been if they told me that I would be up here 2 years later doing one of these lectures about life in the ancient world. Well, here goes. This is, as it's becoming increasingly difficult to forget, an Olympic year. The Olympics have a long history, as we are also often being told, a history which stretches back to ancient Greece. And that link between ancient and modern will be trumpeted again during London 2012, not least at an exhibition entitled The Olympic Journey, to be held at the Royal Albert Hall, which will tell the story of the Olympics from ancient Greece to the present day. And yet, just what picture of the ancient games, and thus our links, the links with our modern Olympics, do we have in our heads? Well, to demonstrate this, I need to all ask for a little audience participation. Now, I mentioned to some members of Darwin College over lunch that I was thinking about doing a little bit of audience participation, and a member of the college, who shall remain nameless, went, eyes lighting up, ooh, symposium, wine, drinking, awesome. No, Dean of the College, wherever you are. It's not that. It's a simple multiple choice quiz. And here's the question. Which of these did form part of the ancient Olympics? Now, the three options are the Olympic torch relay, the marathon race, or male athletes tying up their penises with string. Could I have hands up for the Olympic torch relay? Hands up if you think it did form part of the ancient Olympics. couple of hands, okay. The marathon race, anyone? Some more hands. Male athletes tying up their penises with string. I don't know what that says about you all, that you know that fact. Yes, indeed. It's the last one of these that actually happened in the ancient Olympics. The Olympic torch relay was instituted at the Berlin Olympics of 1936 under Hitler. The marathon race, well, there was a battle of Marathon in the ancient world. Supposedly, someone did run from Marathon back to Athens, but actually, as a race, it wasn't put into the Olympics until the first modern Olympics of 1896. Male athletes tying up their penises with string, on the other hand, this is so demonstrated here by an ancient vase painting, first outlined in E.J. Dingwall's 1925 thesis on male infibulation, now known more as ligaturing, or by its ancient name, kynodesme, dog tying. Well, its purpose was, well, uncertain, actually. We're not quite sure. Some argue it was to avoid unwanted erections. Some to simply keep the penis out of the way when running. Others, an issue of modesty. And still others think it's an issue of sexual attraction. Whatever they were tying their penises up for, it's not just in the details that there are key differences between the ancient and modern games. In fact, I would argue that the entire context and tenor of the games has shifted substantially. The ancient Olympics were held in the middle of a religious sanctuary. This is it, Olympia, in Reconstruction. They were fundamentally tied up with worshipping the gods. Only Greeks could compete. Only men could compete. Women weren't even allowed to watch. The athletes competed naked in many events, and although I've heard rumours that there's a planned naked run down the Mall in front of Buckingham Palace in honour of London 2012, something which classics-loving mayor of London Boris Johnson supposedly is supporting, that's quite a thought. Let's put that over that side. Him running naked down the Mall. It's certainly not something we're going to be seeing at the ancient games themselves. Nor were the ancient Olympics a very pleasant experience. Imagine it, 40,000 Greeks or so, in the middle of a hot Greek summer, camped in tents around the sanctuary and stadium at Olympia, along with all the animals and other foodstuffs to feed them. Imagine the animals that were also sacrificed, their throats slit on some of the 70-plus altars around the religious sanctuary at Olympia, the blood congealing in the heat as parts of their bodies were burnt to the gods and other parts were burnt and cooked for human consumption. Sometimes as many as 100 oxen at a single go. Imagine the human and animal waste building up around the site from a large number of Greeks stuck there for a certain amount of time with no drainage or sanitation, apart from the river. It's not for nothing that the Eleans who ran the sanctuary at Olympia had an altar dedicated specifically to Zeus Apomoios, Zeus, the averter of flies. The ancient version of a rent-a-kill fly zapper. Athletes sweating, bleeding, sometimes dying. Crowds pushing, orators, philosophers, historians, nutcases, mouthing off at every opportunity. Stallholders selling things, politicians bickering. No wonder that the ancient sources talk about the difficulties of getting accommodation. Even Plato had to bunk up in a stranger's tent because he couldn't find a room for himself. And even the difficulty of getting transport away from the games was another massive problem. And there's even one famous proverbial ancient story that says, if you wanted to punish a slave, you sent them to the Olympics. The ancient Olympics are beginning to sound something more unpleasant than even the worst-case scenario envisaged for 2012 by the Daily Mail. Right? Now, of course, there are similarities between the ancient and modern games, and that's exactly the point. In making links between the ancient and modern Olympics, we have, in fact, actively shaped an image of the kind of ancient Olympics we want to be linked to and ignored the rest. We have fashioned a picture of the ancient world in our minds which corresponds to what we like to emphasize in our world today. Now, 2 weeks ago, Robert McFarlane stood here and talked about the different ways in which people have imagined the future, as nature comes to take over the ruined remnants of our world. And in this lecture, I want to turn us around to look at the ruins of our past, focusing particularly on ancient Greece, and think about how and why, over the centuries between them and us, we have gone about formulating a picture of what life was like in the ancient world and the kinds of answers that we have come up with. Now, I want to pick up the story at the moment in which Europe long interested in the surviving ancient literature of ancient Greece, started to become interested again in what was actually physically left in ancient Greece, of ancient Greece. Now, it might well come as a surprise that we haven't always been interested in ruins. It seems that we love our ruins, don't we? Yet if you think that Greece, after the breakup of the Roman Empire, was assumed as an unimportant and difficult to get to backwater of the Byzantine Empire, and then given the split of the schism of 1054, when it became part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and then as a result not particularly sort of the destination of choice for Western Catholics, followed by its absorption into the Ottoman Empire after 1453, it's easy to see why few in Western Europe cared about visiting and about what was there could tell them about life in ancient Greece. And yet, by the 15th century, things are beginning to change. The humanist movement in Italy fostered an interest, once again, not only in the surviving texts of ancient Greece, but also its coins and inscriptions, and gradually in the remains of the place itself. The famous Italian merchant, many of you will have heard of, Cyriac of Ancona, we think this is him, traveled all over the Mediterranean in the second half of the 15th century, trying to map literature onto geography. So what did these early explorers seek, and what picture did they come back with? Cyriac's vision of Greece, informed by ancient literature, was a place full of heroes, legends, powerful gods, civic duty, philosophy. Something expressed well, I think, in Raphael's famous The School of Athens, painted slightly later in 1511, depicting Greek philosophers at conversation. But crucially, what Cyriac and his contemporaries thought could be gained from this physical investigation was the evidence for a picture of an ancient world which the modern world could do well to imitate. The image of life in ancient Greece as a goal to strive for had begun to gather momentum. And it's not a long step from imagining life in ancient Greece as a model for the present to wanting to associate yourself with its surviving remains and in turn to owning them. Through the 15th to 17th centuries, artists directly imported ancient figures into their paintings, and the kings and the aristocracies of European nations, particularly England and France, started to acquire ancient Greek art. The ruins of ancient Greece morphed from object from which lessons could be learnt to a symbol of a gentleman's connoisseurship to pawn in international power politics amongst European royalty, and not in all cases with the resulting respect for the objects themselves, which you might have imagined. One antique column drum we know about, owned by a certain Mr. James Theobald during this period, was apparently used as a rolling pin for his bowling green at his home in Berkshire. But as a result of this development in ancient art connoisseurship, by the late 17th century, the focus of interest in this idealized conception of ancient Greece was also changing. Up to this point, the model had for ancient Greece had often been that of Sparta, they of 300 film fame with their uber six packs, long hair, and Spartan approach to life and art. Thomas Cromwell in the English Civil War was encouraged to be like the Spartan Lycurgus rather than any democratic Athenian politician. But as the arts, their understanding and collection came to be more and more an honorable pursuit in the 16th and 17th centuries, the focus for a model in ancient Greece began to shift from Spartan Sparta to artistic Athens. That is to say, as the modern world's interests changed, in part thanks to the reappearance of ancient Greek ruins, so too did the modern world's focus on what was best in ancient Greece, and as a result, the emphasis of the portrait painted of life in the ancient Greek world. The ancient Greeks were no longer only sharpening their swords to kill, they were also sharpening their tools to carve. And yet while the notion of Greece, and particularly Athens, as an ideal was developing alongside the acquisition of bits of its ruins, just what picture of life and the landscape, the world of ancient Greece was being formulated? The irony is that apart from depictions in the surviving literary sources, no one had a clue as to what ancient Greece had really looked like. Despite pilfering many of its surviving pieces of art, there was still no sustained interest in investigating, recording, or understanding what was left of its life and landscape. Raphael's School of Athens, 1511, not only brings pretty much every Greek philosopher known to man in one room at the same time, but puts them in a room which is pretty Roman, actually, when you look at it, and entirely made up. In 1554, a century after Cyriac of Ancona had done his travels, Martin Krauss, a Greek scholar at Tübingen University in Germany, wrote to Theodorus Sigomalas, a Greek in Constantinople, to inquire whether Athens still existed or whether it had been replaced by a fishing village. Poussin's 1648 body of Phocion being carried out of Athens records a key historical moment in Athens' history as presented in the literary sources. But his vision of ancient Athens behind is almost entirely made up based on his imagination and from his reading of the sources. Indeed, so flexible was the public's impression of ancient Athens that Guy de Saint-Georges, in the second half of the 17th century, was able to publish a highly successful book about Athens based on a fictional visit by his fictional brother. I'm reminded of a fantastic article in the online satirical newspaper The Onion in 2010, in which ancient historians finally admitted that they had entirely made up the ancient world. It had started as a bit of a gag, and suddenly they found themselves having to produce ancient pots all night long and go along and sort of thing. Well, you know, hey, that's not quite true, I promise. All right? I absolutely promise. Now, Greece, it seems, was an ideal because, to some extent, it was a blank canvas onto which people could impose their own ideas picked up through their own interpretations of the literary sources. Moreover, what is fascinating is that for many, the notion of ancient Greece as an ideal demanded the corresponding belief that there was nothing left of it to find, even if they went looking, a thought which extended to assuming the ignorance of the modern Greeks about their glorious ancestry. So Guy de Saint-Georges' book also poked fun at the way in which the modern Greeks actually played up to European expectations by feigning particular ignorance about their ancient culture in their presence. Right? They started acting dumb the moment a European turned up on the scene. In the last decades of the 17th century, however, this interest in art began to encourage people systematically to fill in that blank canvas and record what was left of ancient Greece. The Capuchin monks, originally sent in by the French to convert the Orthodox Greeks, started making maps of ancient Athens. Painters attached to the French ambassador to the Ottomans, the Marquis de Noantel, made the first sketches of the Parthenon and its sculptures. The first detailed investigations and drawings of surviving monuments around Greece were undertaken by these two, Jacob Spon and George Vila, who had to convince the Turkish soldiers that they were not spies. The Turks found the measuring of these ancient blocks very suspicious indeed, and most of the time had to bribe them. So 12.5 kilograms of coffee got Spon access to the Acropolis when he was there on his visit. And by the end of the 17th century, then, the picture of life in ancient Greece had been established as an ideal, its ruins as valuable commodities, but the nature of that picture was still largely a creation of European imagination and ancient literature, with increasing pockets of more detailed knowledge of surviving ruins, especially in the now very fashionable to admire Athens. But even those surviving pieces were themselves sometimes brutally reshaped to fit in with modern European morality. The Duke de Mazarin, taking over Richelieu's collection in the Palais Royal in 1670, went round with a hammer, knocking off the genitals of ancient statues, so affronted was he by their nudity. And this sense of effrontery at an attempt to disguise the seeming sexual liberation of the ancient world would continue for a long time. Visit any collection of ancient Greek art today, and you will see any number of ancient statues that have had a fig leaf added to their nether regions, not irregularly on the direct orders of the Pope himself, as was the case with this statue, the Apollo Belvedere. And this would continue all the way through. There's a famous story that Queen Victoria absolutely hated seeing genitals on ancient statues, and they had a sort of portable fig leaf that could be transported around, popped in front of any statue that she was going to see. By the beginning of the 18th century, the ability to fictionalize completely a tour of ancient and modern Greece was no longer viable. Guy de Saint-Georges' famous book was exposed as a forgery to the outrage of everyone in London by Spon and Rila. In its place, the new craze was Homer, and particularly the ability to link the locations in Homer's text in the Greek landscape, and in so doing, to link life in ancient and modern Greece back together, because it was felt Homer's genius had originally emerged from a contemplation of that same landscape. The pleasure of reading Homer was immeasurably improved by reading it in the locations he was talking about. But at the same time, that process affirmed a change in the perception of the realities of ancient Greece. As Goethe later said, we stopped seeing in Homer's poems a strained and inflated world of fabulous heroes and saw instead the true reflection of a primitive reality. Now, I can't magically transport us all to Greece as much as I would like to do on this cold evening, but I can at least bring Homer off the page and allow us a brief experience of what listening to Homer in the original Greek might have sounded like. The recording we're about to hear is of Homer Odyssey, Book 9, and is provided by Anthony Bowen of Jesus College, who has asked me to inform the experts amongst you that he has chosen to recite this time in 5th century Attic dialect. Right? So you can just situate yourselves, exactly. This is the section where the hero Odysseus stabs a red-hot stick into the eye of the one-eyed Cyclops monster. So you can see here in this image here, here's the stick going into the Cyclops monster's eye. And I'll sort of run down with the laser pointer where we are in the translation. Have a listen.
Hos du en opthalmo, pyriake amoklon helontes dineomen, don haime perirre termoneonta, banta de hoi bleparamphig ae opruas heusen aut me glenes cae omenes, sparagaunto de hoi pyrirrisdae.
There we go. Imagine reading that in the Cyclops cave. In part linked to this newfound desire to read Homer in situ, European knowledge of ancient Greek art and architecture was increasing leaps and bounds, but it was also due more generally to the greater ability to travel in this region, and indeed the social desirability of travel. The grand tour was now a fixed part of any gentleman's upbringing, and the Society of the Dilettanti was formed in 1734 in England for aristocrats who had visited Italy, and it's rumoured you had to have been drunk there as well to become a member. The Society went on to fund numerous voyages to ancient lands and their resulting publications, like that of Richard Chandler, 1764-66, and critically, those of James Athenian Stuart and Nicholas Rivette, who published detailed plans of many of the ancient Greek temples and buildings in several volumes after 1762. Copying these structures became de rigueur. The Monument of Lysicrates, published here in the Stuart and Rivette, seen here in one of the earliest photos of Athens, is James Robertson in 1853, and this is how it is today, was copied far and wide, as far and wide, in fact, as Philadelphia in the United States, where it crowned the Merchants Exchange Building, completed in the early 19th century. Yet Greek architecture was not the only focus of interest, particularly for German scholars, including the famous Johann Winckelmann. Now, the Germans had only really recently become interested in ancient Greece, thanks to this new craze for Homer and the Greek landscape. And Winckelmann now led the way with his construction of the first history of ancient Greek art. Indeed, so keen on Greece was Winckelmann that he famously claimed in a letter to his friend, "I have never wanted anything so passionately as this, the chance to visit Greece. I wouldn't mind losing a finger. In fact, I wouldn't mind losing my balls for such a chance of getting to see those countries." Not joking. But, and here's the rub, he never went, despite numerous opportunities. Whatever his protestations, the first scholar to deliver a history of Greek art did so very much from Rome. And despite the distance, Winckelmann's influence on the nature of Greek art and thus the nature of the ancient Greek world in which it had been created was fundamental. So using statues like the Apollo Belvedere, the same statue to which Winckelmann was forced to witness the Pope ordering the attachment of a fig leaf in 1759, Winckelmann argued that the production of great art was tied to political and social freedom. But he also trumpeted the noble simplicity and calm grandeur of Greek sculpture. The highlighting of simplicity and grandeur made possible by liberty chimed with the goal of the modern European Enlightenment, the promotion of nature and reason. As a result, this new vision of life in ancient Greece was able to continue smoothly as a new ideal for a new modern society. And particularly in Germany, the Greek ideal rose to new and giddy heights. Wilhelm von Humboldt, Minister of Education in the late 18th century in Prussia, commented, "Knowledge of the Greeks is not merely pleasant, useful, or necessary to us. No, in the Greeks alone, we find the ideal of that which we should like to be and produce. From the Greeks, we take something more than earthly, something godlike." But did this continued, indeed increased, idealization of life in ancient Greece still demand a counterpart expectation of ignorance amongst the modern Greeks? Well, the issue was hotly debated. Edward Gibbon continued the more traditional line that the modern Greeks were pale imitations of their ancestors. He said, "It would not be easy in the country of Plato and Demosthenes to find a reader or indeed a copy of their works. The Athenians walk with supine indifference amongst the glorious ruins of antiquity." Yet some felt the exact opposite. Pierre-Augustin Guise, in 1771, published his account of a comparison between the ancient and modern Greeks and their values, arguing that the modern Greeks had much of the ancient spirit. That meant both a natural simplicity and occasionally a tendency to be, in his words, artful, vain, and not very scrupulous observers of their oaths. Now, Guise's work was political in two ways. First, because it threw stones at the overly fussy and degenerate culture of aristocratic Western Europe. The sentence, "Such were the simplicity and good sense of ancient manners, we are far removed from them today," was actually deleted from the English translation. And it's not just the English who felt themselves a target. Winckelmann also expressed something along these lines against the French. He said, "The French are irredeemable. Classical antiquity and the French are at opposite poles." But his work also intimated that the modern Greeks, currently still under Turkish occupation, were merely dormant and had it in them to return to the glories of their ancient ancestors. Guy boasted Catherine the Great of Russia as one of his avid readers, and it's no surprise that she, in 1770, had a hand in inciting the Greeks to rebel against the Turks. But the dismal failure of that rebellion had the unfortunate result of encouraging many to side with Gibbon, that the modern Greeks simply weren't up to their ancestors' standard. By the end of the 18th century, then, the answer to the question, what was life like in ancient Greece, was perhaps even more complex than it had been a century earlier. On the one hand, it was all about noble simplicity, calm grandeur, naturalism, and reason that could be understood for some only up close in the landscape with Homer in hand, and for others from afar through its art. That noble simplicity, made possible by ancient liberty, in turn was portrayed either as a goal for modern Europe enlightenment and the Enlightenment to head towards, also as a stick with which to punish those countries who were now thought to be too over-sophisticated, as well as cover to hint for greater political and social freedom in European society. Yet at the same time, depending on how you read the character of the modern Greeks, ancient Greece was either totally lost or, in fact, balanced on the edge of a comeback. Now, I thought we might have, and here is a sort of a wonderful Stuart and Rivette etching of ancient Greece, modern Greece, all mixed together. I particularly like the detail of adding the birds nesting on the top of one of the ancient monuments. I thought we might need an interlude at this moment. Now, it's often said that one of the best ways to get to know a culture is through its humour. And in fact, it's rumoured that in the 4th century BC in Greece, a group of sort of 60 Athenians used to gather by the Temple of Heracles in Athens and sort of tell jokes to one another, a sort of ancient version of the Cambridge Footlights smoker session, stand-up comedy routines. And Philip of Macedon apparently paid a huge amount of money at one point to sort of get these guys to write down their jokes and send them up to him in northern Greece. But we don't have that text surviving, but we do have a sort of compilation of ancient jokes that has survived called the Philogelos. And I thought I'd try a few out on you here, see whether you find them amusing or not. The first kind of line was about idiot jokes, lots of idiot jokes from the ancient world. So there was a numbskull who wanted to swim, who nearly drowned. So he swore not to touch water again before he'd learnt to swim. When a talkative barber asked, "How shall I cut you?" a wit replied, "In silence, please." There's groans already, isn't there? Come on. And my personal favourite, in the market, a man came to complain. "The slave you sold me yesterday has died." The seller replied, "That's very strange. He never did anything like that when he was with me." Oh, yeah, they work, despite not too much lost in translation. Funny lot, those Greeks. But I digress. The 19th century was to prove no less complex in its attitudes towards ancient Greece and its image of ancient Greek life. by the beginning of the 19th century, in part because more and more people were travelling to Greece, seeing its current state of desolation, hearing about the lackluster performance of the modern Greeks compared to their ancient Greek ideal, the overall impression of life in ancient Greece began to take on a foreign, distant note. As Leslie Hartley later put it in the novel The Go-Between, 1953, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And art, at the same time, seemed to capture this distant, foreign otherness of the ancient world. Paintings in the early 19th century, an example here and here, are sort of always bathed in this haze of golden light, which is the antithesis of the often extraordinarily clear outlines and quality of light natural to Greece, if you can get away from the Athenian smog, that is. Even the artistic vision of ancient Greece, it seems at this time, was separated from the modern viewer by a mist. The irony is that just as for some life in ancient Greece seemed more distant, for others knowledge and attachment to the Greek landscape was also becoming stronger than ever. Edward Clarke, travelling to Greece in 1800 to 1801, claimed that Epidauria is a region as easily to be visited as Derbyshire. And it wasn't just that visiting Greece was easier than it had been, it was that every part of the Greek landscape mirrored that of the English landscape. So Thessaly was the Yorkshire Dales, Liguria was Cheltenham. And at the same time, the first expeditions intent not just on drawing sculpture and architecture, but on mapping the Greek landscape set out. This is the British Army officer William Martin Leake in his travels in Greece, 1805 to 7, 1809 to 10, who established the location of many of the sort of famed yet so far lost sites of mainland ancient Greece. This is one of his maps here. And whether ancient Greece was like a foreign country, or whether its modern landscape was like Cheltenham, Europe still wanted to own what remained. In 1801 to 3, Lord Elgin packed 100 cases of Parthenon sculpture to ship to London. In 1812, the sculptures of the Temple of the Fire on Egina were sold to King Ludwig of Bavaria. Nor was this only happening in Greece. The French at this time carried off the Luxor obelisk to stand in the Place de la Concorde in Paris. And however we want to view those actions today, at the time, the main players were adamant of their moral right to do this. Antiquity, said Captain de Vernignac Saint-Maur, who was responsible for carrying off the obelisk to Paris, is a garden that belongs by natural right to those who cultivate its fruits. Yet in bringing these sculptures to London, another debate was ignited about the nature of Greek art and ancient Greece itself. Seeing the Parthenon sculptures up close, represented here, artists and scholars expecting the kind of noble simplicity of Winckelmann were astounded by the detailed rendition of human reality. Greek art was no longer about a mathematical canon of beauty, it was about real human beings. So fundamental was this change that many at first felt driven to deny the Parthenon sculptures entirely as a work of Greek art. Richard Knight, on behalf of the Society of the Dilettanti, argued that Elgin had misidentified as Greek what were in fact Roman sculptures from the time of Hadrian. It was not until 1816 that Elgin was able to convince the British Museum of their veracity and worth and get them to buy them. Now, the Greek War of Independence, 1821 to 29, called the bluff on European claims to idealize ancient Greece. Some of Europe put their lives where their admiration led them. The Germans sent 300 fighters to help the Greeks more than any other nation. And Lord Byron, famous Lord Byron, who not only wrote many poems extolling the virtues of ancient Greece and vociferously attacked Lord Elgin at the time for his taking of the Parthenon sculpture, Childe Harold, but also recreated famous ancient acts like Lysander's swim across the Bosphorus from Sestos to Abydos to his beloved. Byron died while fighting at Messalonghi as a freedom fighter for the Greeks. Here he can be seen as a young man, and here in his more exotic local dress. And this portrait can still be seen today hanging in the British ambassador's residence in Athens. And also, in case any of you were thinking about undertaking Byron's legendary swim across the Bosphorus from Sestos to Abydos, it's done as a yearly event now that you can sort of subscribe and raise money for. I was talking to someone who did it recently, and I would advise blocking up your ears and nose with wax because the water is absolutely filthy. The poor chap was ill for quite a few weeks afterwards. I think it's much better to stick with Byron's pool here in Grantchester. Without doubt, the war also helped close the gap once again between a distant ancient Greece and the modern present. For the modern Greeks fighting in the war, it was time to step up and be found equal to their ancestors. As Alexandros Hypsilantis, one of the early Greek leaders in the war, exclaimed in 1821, "Brave and valiant Greeks, let us remember the ancient freedom of Greece, the battles of Marathon and Thermopylae. Let us fight on the tombs of our ancestors who fell for the sake of our freedom." It's interesting to note, too, that in the decades after the war, ancient Greek names became increasingly popular in modern Greece as they sought to strengthen their connection with their past. But for Europe, the War of Independence also ignited an ever stronger bond between modern Europe and ancient Greece, as expressed through the recognition of the Greek impact on the European present. John Stuart Mill, in 1846, is famed as saying that the true ancestors of the European nations are not those from whose blood they are sprung, but those from whom they derive the richest portion of their inheritance. The Battle of Marathon, even as an event in British history, is more important than the Battle of Hastings. If the issue of that day had been different, the Britons and the Saxons might still have been wandering in the woods. The rest of the 19th century bore the fruit of this belief in and determination to foster European closeness to ancient Greece. As Greece itself was tied closer into Europe with the establishment of Prince Otto of Bavaria as the king of the Hellenes in 1833, so too progressed the development of the scientific study of Greece's ancient remains, along with the need to protect them by both Greeks and by other European nations. So the Acropolis was declared the first archaeological site in 1834. In 1836, the first archaeological law was passed in Greece, regulating what could and could not be sold, and was supplemented by a second law in 1899. In 1837, the Greek Archaeological Society was founded. In 1846, the French excavation school in Athens was set up. In 1874, the famous Heinrich Schliemann published, or rather adorned his wife with, the results of his excavations at Troy. And in 1876, he began to dig at Mycenae with the result here of the famous grave mask of Agamemnon. In 1874, too, the German Archaeological Institute was opened in Athens. And in 1875, the first of the big digs commenced at Olympia, which was entirely buried underneath meters of alluvial sediment. This is Olympia before, and this is Olympia after the excavations got going. And in 1892, finally, the excavation of Delphi began as well, which again was a mammoth task. The entire modern village had to be destroyed and removed from above the ancient site here. Now, a lot of fun, it seems, was had by the archaeologists during this time. I love this photo because it's of Wilhelm Dortfeld, one of the most serious and prolific German scholars of the time. But as this picture reveals, he's not above a good gag with a Grecian urn, which, you know, we all love, really, don't we? But at the same time, it's important to remember that all of these works represented huge financial investment by the European nations in Greece. What picture of life in ancient Greece, then, did these advances, the birth of archaeology itself as an academic discipline, have to offer? Well, on the one hand, of course, apart from simply exposing key sites, it brought huge advances in understanding their nature. Careful examination of temples, for example, during the second half of the 19th century proved that they had been painted, a fact that astonished a world so used to purely white marble classical ruins, who now had to confront an ancient world looking like one of the kitschiest places on earth. This is a reconstruction of one of the Greek temples in Sicily, and this, a personal favourite, is Heracles from the pedimental sculpture of the Temple of Aphire at Aeginae. I think you'll agree it's a rather charming multicoloured lycra suit that Heracles is sporting. Yet, with the exception of Schliemann's famous discoveries at Troy and Mycenae, as well as the British archaeologist Arthur Evans digging at Knossos on Crete, the focus was most often on creating a picture of the ancient world in what was considered to be its heyday, the 5th century BC, the acme of the classical period, the time of the Athenian democracy, the empire, and the Parthenon. The Acropolis, for example, when it was turned into an archaeological site, was stripped of its complex history here, sort of seen in the Stuart and Rivette etching, and brought back to the 5th century. Right? That's the ancient past we want to see and remember. The development of archaeology in Greece and the resultant display of a particular era of real ancient Greece also did little to kill off the imagined ideal of ancient Greece. Indeed, this ideal was busy morphing once again, all on its own. In part thanks to the age of industrialization in the second half of the 19th century, the concept of Greece as a timeless, intellectual, hazy world was set aside in European art, and it became instead a spectacular realm of endless holiday. Ancient Greece was now a place of escape from the realities of the European world. This is Lord Leighton's Greeks Play Girls Playing Ball from 1889, which I think captures brilliantly this sort of sense of carefree, almost sensual abandonment. It could do well as a Santorini travel brochure front cover, I think. The very forces of idealization that had provoked an interest in the surviving remains of the ancient Greek world and led ultimately to the birth of archaeology now not only continued unchecked by what those remains had to say, but offered a very much alternative kind of picture. And in the same period, and in complete contrast to either the ruins or the Greek girls playing at ball, the view of ancient Greek life through its surviving text was also reframed, in particular by the work of Friedrich Nietzsche, who published in the 1870s his work on Greek tragedy, offering a fundamental revision of ancient Greece as a place of both light and dark, of constructive and destructive forces, for the powers of the god Apollo and Dionysus. For Nietzsche, the idealization of Greece was a symptom of ignorance about the real antiquity, a place that would horrify the modern world. Thus, as the modern world emerged from the Victorian age into the 20th century, life in ancient Greece was simultaneously a Butlin's holiday camp, a world of light and tragic cruelty, an everlasting ideal, as well as a place whose ruins, most often 5th century and, if you could, democratic ruins, were increasingly coming into focus and, as a result, could be studied, catalogued, and grasped. Just, I can't resist an aside. I don't know about you from following these lectures so far, but one thing that's come out at me incredibly strongly is a renewed appreciation for the advances made in the last quarter of the 19th century. We saw in the first lecture that Michael Aiken was showing how in 1897 the structure of a snail embryo was being brilliantly documented in detail. Robert McFarlane showed how in 1885 Richard Jefferies was imagining future ruins in After London. And Francis Ashcroft revealed how Thompson in 1876 was busy discovering the condition of Myotonia congenita. And at the same time, they were digging up half of Greece. It's an impressive period. Who knows what this era will have been found to have discovered in the subsequent lectures as we go through. I can't also resist just one other small digression. One of the delightful things about Darwin is that you end up listening to conversations from people entirely unrelated to your particular field. And one of these happened just the other day. When you do any kind of lecture training, they tell you about the 20-minute attention span curve of your audience. So I can see you're already sort of way past that. But what I was told by a criminologist in Darwin recently is that it's not just attention that wanes, it's also your leniency that nosedives. A famous study of Israeli parole boards was done that showed that while over the course of the entire day they gave about a third of people parole, actually that was at 65% just after breakfast, after morning coffee, after lunch, and after afternoon tea. And that went all the way down to about 35% just before morning coffee, before lunch, before afternoon tea. So, wine is not that far away, I promise. I'm craving your indulgence for just a little while longer. Please give me parole. Ancient Greece continued to play its role as an inspirational ideal well into the 20th century. Buses in London during World War I carried excerpts from the speeches of Thucydides as inspirational adverts, only possible because ancient Greek literature was so well embedded, you know, in the education system. Indeed, it was felt that somehow the modern Western European world was now tied tight with ancient Greece, an entire reverse from the period just a century before when that sense of distance had suddenly raised its head. In a Berlin bookshop not long ago, I came across a 1921 volume edited by Richard Livingston on the legacy of Greece. And the preface that he writes makes this European close relationship with ancient Greece very clear. This is what he says. In spite of many differences, no age has had closer affinities with ancient Greece than our own. History does not repeat itself. Yet if the 20th century searched through its past for its nearest spiritual kin, it is in the 5th and following centuries BC that they would be found. Again and again, as we study Greek thought behind the veil woven by time and distance, the face that meets us is our own, younger, with fewer lines and wrinkles on its features, and with more definite and deliberate purpose in its eyes. For these reasons, we are today in a position as no other age has been to understand ancient Greece, to learn the lessons it teaches, and in studying the ideals and fortunes of men with whom we have so much in common, to gain a fuller power of understanding and estimating of our own. Now, one of the ironies of this close family bond between early 20th century Europe, or its academics at least, and ancient Greece is that at exactly the same time, the art world, which had for so long fanned the flames of idealized interpretations of Greece at the beginning of the 20th century, began to dispense with it. So post-impressionist artists like Cézanne started labeling its imitation pernicious, and the Dada movement in the 1920s suggested letting Laocoon, one of the most famous ancient sculptures, Hellenistic known through Roman copy, and his children, the Dada movement said, let Laocoon and his children rest after their thousand-year-long struggle with that fine sausage of a serpent. Yet it's also important to realize that this sense of affinity felt in intellectual circles between ancient and modern Greece did not cover over the seeds of doubt sowed by Nietzsche and others about the dual nature of the ancient Greek world, its light and dark, creativity and cruelty. In an article in Livingstone's volume entitled, and this is the best title of any article I've ever read, entitled The Value of Greece to the Future of the World, by Gilbert Murray, he tackles this Janus-like quality. On the one hand, the language of Greek poetry has an austere beauty because the people were, in his words, habitually toned to a higher level of intensity and nobility than ours. On the other, Murray argues, the Greeks were separated by a thin and precarious interval from the savage. Scratch a Russian, Murray continued, and you find a wild Tartar. Scratch an ancient Greek, and you hit, no doubt, on a very primitive and formidable being somewhere between a Viking and a Polynesian. The dual savage and cultured nature of ancient Greece has not been, of course, the only fascination for academic scholarship during the 20th and 21st centuries, although the Viking-Polynesian contrast kept me fascinated for quite a while. It would be impossible here to list all the developments across the fields of classical study and how they have impacted upon our impression of life in ancient Greece, but it's crucial to note that while many of these developments and their resulting impressions have come about thanks to new critical theories or new technologies, just as many of them have been motivated principally thanks to pressure, as in previous centuries, from wider historical, social, and political attitudes and events. So Hitler's championing of the competitive, elitist aspects of ancient Greece ensured that money was available for the Germans to dig out the stadium at Olympia, which had hitherto, this is the stadium here, which had hitherto been left unexcavated. In contrast, post-World War II, with Europe exhausted, America came to the fore in archaeology in Europe, with the study of ancient Greece exploding, but with a very particular emphasis on ancient Greece's credentials for freedom and democracy, with a resulting swing back from Olympia to Athens. In 1952-6, the Americans paid to rebuild the Stoa of Attalus here in the Agora in Athens. And in contrast, scholars have shown how Russian interest in ancient Greece, dating back to Catherine the Great, was preconditioned for much of the 20th century by the politics of the Soviet Union, with its scholars choosing to emphasize an ancient Greece which was a pre-capitalist social system relying on slave modes of production. And even the development of the European Union project after 1958 encouraged many to emphasize the pan-Hellenic united aspects of ancient Greece, particularly its sanctuaries like Delphi, Olympia, or Delos, as forerunners of this modern European idea. So when UNESCO made Delphi a World Cultural Heritage Site in 1987, it cited as an explicit reason Delphi's enduring ability to bring people together. And how, you may ask, amongst all this, have the Greeks themselves characterized life in ancient Greece? Well, from being lampooned as ignorant of their ancestry during the 17th century, the Greeks created an active linkage with it in the run-up to and following the War of Independence in the early 19th century. That link, of course, is still with us today and very strong. Alexander the Great was recently voted as the greatest Greek of all time on Greek national television, and it's a heritage they guard with high passion. A German magazine is currently being sued in the Greek courts for representing an ancient Greek goddess raising her finger to Europe. Yet modern Greece has also sought to mix that ancient heritage with another critical element of its past, that of Byzantine and Orthodox Greece. There is still in Greek a term, excuse my pronunciation, Greeks amongst you, Hellen Orthodoxos Politismos, Greek Orthodox civilization, which evokes a blending of ancient Greece and Orthodox Christianity in which some continue to call on as an ideal. Moreover, their view of life in ancient Greece has remained far from static. In post-World War II Greek poetry, for example, the ancient landscape is no longer blue skies and sunshine, but a place of oppressive desolation. And furthermore, Greece itself has the difficulty of having to face up to the issue of how to live their modern lives amongst the ruins of ancient Greece. Now, this came to a head during the heavy summer fires in 2007, when fire engines were diverted from saving modern Greek houses to protect the ancient stones at Olympia. This is the scene of the fire damage on the hill. These are the stones of Olympia here, the fire damage here. For some Greece, at least, that decision was wrong. And the nation had its priorities wrong. Ancient Greece, for some in Greece, had become very much a weight around their necks. Now, as one of my rather keen students once said, this is all very interesting, but what's the point? Ask an impertinent question and you're on your way to a pertinent answer, I said. The point is that our vision of life in ancient Greece has always been tied tightly to the events, attitudes and needs of our own world. As a result, our impression of ancient Greek life and the level of importance it has for modern society has not just changed over time, but has also been dynamic and multiple at any one time. It has morphed, been contested and circled around time and again as a fictional ideal and primitive reality, distant foreign land and family member, place of noble simplicity, savage cruelty, name but a few of its incarnations. As the archaeologist Michael Shanks put it in 1996, the classical past does not reveal itself in its essential character, it has to be worked for. This leads us to the question, what sort of classical past do we want? Or as the 1989 Bluffer's Guide to Classics puts it, in many bluffs, you run the risk of coming across someone who might spot you. But with the classics, you may assume a reckless confidence, as academics can never agree about anything. Harsh, but perhaps not unfair sometimes. And the Bluffer's Guide brings out, I think, another important point. Because of the way in which Europe and America, amongst others, have particularly kept the changing world of ancient Greece, and equally Rome in this picture, over the centuries front and center in their mindsets, that world is perhaps not only more highly debated than other subjects in the Bluffer's Guide series, but also, as a result, has a power which punches way above its weight in comparison to other great periods of world history. So the question might become to your lips, well, what about the future? Will that continue as it has done in the past? The argument has been made many times by classicists themselves that we cannot rely on ancient Greece to have the same kind of stake, if indeed any stake, in the 21st and coming centuries as it has done in the past. And many of you will be aware of the continuing fight for the relevance of studying the ancient world in school curriculums as well as at university level. Who can forget Boris Johnson in his toga outside Parliament championing the saviour of ancient history A-level? Now, that war is certainly not over, but I think some battles are being won. For sure, putting excerpts of Thucydides on buses as inspirational messages would look a little bit odd now, I think. And I doubt that anyone would claim, as Livingstone did, that we are a sort of mirror reflection of ancient Greece, or agree with John Stuart Mill that Marathon is more important than Hastings. But on the other hand, the evidence is, I think, that the study of the ancient world continues to have relevance and, more importantly, to thrive and captivate. Numerous individuals, societies, associations and projects, for example, are working hard at grassroots level, helping with the often very popular reintroduction of ancient languages into our schools. And despite some universities narrowing their ancient world study options, others are actually increasing their provision, and numbers of students in classics-related subjects at universities in the UK remains healthy. Popular interest is also strong. We have films like The 300, which took $72 million on its opening weekend. I'd realised I had a typo in this just before I came up here, that I'd actually just written $72 in its opening weekend, which doesn't sound so impressive, but $72 million is much better. Not bad for ancient history, and the number of films about sword and sandal epics about the ancient world just continues to sort of grow and grow. And the sequel to Clash of the Titans is on our screen soon. Make sure you go and watch. More frivolously, we can take these things as indicators. Vera Wang's ancient Greece wedding dress is apparently one of the most popular in her collection. And this is a slightly risque image coming up here, so turn away if you want to. Karl Lagerfeld himself modestly said that what Homer did with the pen, he did with the camera lens when he dedicated the 2011 Pirelli calendar to Greek myth. Karl Lagerfeld comparing himself to Homer. Nice one. Nor has ancient Greece died as a comparative ideal. When I was teaching in a university in Rio in 2010, the police there were being hailed as Spartan heroes. That was a language that could be used in the daily newspapers, which had currency, had value. American Marines are often being compared to Spartans, and officers are even issued with books on Spartan history as part of their training, written, I think, by members of the audience here tonight. And with the current Greek economic crisis as litmus test of the wider world financial problem, it's not surprising that once again we find ourselves reading lots of articles about ancient ideals and modern realities. My favourite was that apparently, according to the newspapers, the first global economic crisis in history was in ancient Greece, when a number of city-states in the 4th century BC were unable to pay back their loans to the Temple of Apollo on Delos. Plus ça change, they say. Look at this. They've always been causing us trouble. The cycle, it seems, of interest in and debate over life in ancient Greece seems to be continuing. There is a saying that only the future is certain. It's the past that's always changing. Now, while I hope to have shown you that the past is always most definitely changing, my bet is that the only certainty about the future is that it will continue to do so. None of this should make us complacent in any way. If interest in life in ancient Greece is to continue in the longer term, it will only be because the argument for its continuing intellectual, social, political, and cultural relevance continues to be forcefully made and won, both in academic, educational, and most importantly, public arenas. But for my part, I think that in that continuing debate, we need to be more insistent on two aspects of life in ancient Greece. It's these two aspects that I want to leave you with. Firstly, as with the ancient Olympics example with which we started, we need to work hard to keep in mind both the attractive and non-attractive bits of the ancient world. A place of beautiful things and ideas, sure, but also full of difficulties and dangers that had to be lived with by the people on a daily basis. And the second is that ancient Greece was not a monolithic whole, but a place itself filled with a myriad of different views and approaches to life, which were all changing and adapting to the wider world around them. And if I were to leave you with just one impression of life in the ancient Greek world tonight, I would like it to be that. Not just a place of beautiful ruins, philosophers, and six-packs, but a place packed full of vibrant and sometimes very different ideas and forces, evolving within a harsh, challenging, and uncertain world. A place we may want to admire, but difficult to pin down, and one I would wager few of us would ever like to find ourselves for real. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Well, Michael, thank you for the appetizer for the London Olympics, not least in priapic fashions. It's deeply reassuring for those of us like myself who lost out on the ticket lottery. I suppose it's trite to say that the past is a mirror in which we see ourselves. What I found so interesting about Michael's talk was in the past we see what we'd like to be like and how that continues over the ages, and how if that isn't what you find in the past, you bash the stones about until you get them to confess it. You won't escape you the irony that we've been hearing about this strange idealistic view of classical Greece at just the time when the Greek economy is threatened, and indeed, in due course, Greek democracy will be threatened by the Greek crisis, and thereby threatening the whole of our pan-European dream. But that was great fun, Michael. Thank you so much.